As many of you know, David and I spent the last week in Carmel, just an hour and a half down the road from here. Swami Kriyananda, the founder of our community, some of you are new here, so you don't know all the names. Swamiji, we call him, is the direct disciple of Paramhansa Yogananda, and he's the spiritual leader of Ananda and the founder of our community. Yogananda himself, whom we call Master, passed away in 1952, and Swami Kriyananda, at the age of 86, is one of the last living disciples. Swamiji wanted a break from tremendously busy summer, because even at the age of 86, he's written 4 or perhaps 5 books this last year, and is involved in 3 full-length movies and a whole bunch of other stuff. And he just wanted a break from everything, so last Saturday when I was up in Ananda Village where he's living, he asked if David and I would take him and Narayani, the woman who takes care of him, down to Carmel for 4 days. So that's what we did. Not a hardship assignment, I admit. Carmel is a place that Swamiji has been going to, well, as long as I've known him, 40 years. We've been going down there quite often. It's amazing now to be with Swamiji at the age that he is now. And it's an interesting contrast for me. Many of you, I draw my examples of spiritual life out of my regular life, so you all know all about the circumstances in which I live. Last January, my uncle, at the age of 95 or 96, passed away. His wife, who was 89, passed away a few months before that. And for several years, I would go back to Pennsylvania, where they lived, and would just spend some time with them. Prior to that, my father in his 80s passed away. So I've had this experience in the last few years of being with people in the last quadrant of their life, living through what they're living through before the body goes away. Let's just say there's a lot of contrast between my uncle and Swami Kriyananda. Swami Kriyananda is a man who has dedicated his entire life, ever since he was 22 years old, to being a disciple of a great guru, to attuning himself to that consciousness, and to simply living as master's instrument, and that's been his only desire. My uncle was a very good man by any standard that you use in the world. Not a devout man, no sense of God, in fact, strongly, definitely, emphatically against God. And because he got a little confused toward the end of his life, I had this marvelous experience once of sitting with him at lunch while he mocked my spiritual teachings and told everyone that we had to rescue Asha from this terrible group that she's part of. And everyone else was very embarrassed for me. I was just quite amused. He was just too disconnected to realize how intensely inappropriate this was. But I watched him as his body disintegrated, go through this intense fight to remain in control of absolutely everything. And it attained in, you know, kind of ludicrous proportions, as sometimes when people's brains are not working well, there was this bagel that sat on the table on a plate for the last practically year of his life. The plate, and it had all these signs, do not move, do not disturb. He had like sort of staked it out as his turf, and he was just going to hold it there. And he even knew it was somewhat ridiculous, but at the same time, you touched that bagel at your peril. And he loved to replay all the things that he was angry about and all the stupid things that people had done in his life and why, if they'd only listened to him, it wouldn't have happened that way. He was a highly intelligent man, extremely capable, and he didn't suffer fools gladly, and his definition of fools was really, really big, really, really wide. And he would repeat, as older people often do, because he didn't have good short-term memory, so he would tell me there's some incident having to do with the builders and how they didn't do it correctly. The details escape me at this point because I've tried my best to forget them. And it would always end with some outrageous little campaign about how incompetent they were and if they'd only listened to him. And that was a general feeling about how he felt at the time, because he couldn't do anything for himself, and he was always annoyed because he wasn't in command anymore. And at one point, after he'd repeated about 5 times this story, and I was trying my best to deflect him, but he was still smart enough to know that I was trying to deflect him. "Let me finish," he finally said, and I thought, okay, let him finish. And after it was finally done, I said to him, his name was Ted, "Uncle Ted," I said, "do you like just replaying all the things you're angry about?" "Yes," he said, just like that. "Oh, okay," you know, and I began to laugh because from my point of view, I thought at that stage of his life, he would want to get over it, you know, like just get over it. But no, for him, this was still where his sense of self, where his power came from, where his sense of self-worth, you know, all those different qualities, and he had so little left, he was just determined to act out the fragment that he still had. I loved visiting them because it really stiffened my spine for the spiritual life. Did your mother ever say to you, "If you keep making that ugly face, your face is going to get stuck like that someday"? Well, I would watch my dear uncle, and I would think, "My gosh, you kept making that ugly thought, and now your brain is stuck there, isn't it?" And that was exactly what he was doing. He was just living out, you know, as his world diminished, he just clung to those things that were the most valuable to him, and he just lived them through and lived them through and lived them through. And he had good karma, too. So I don't think the end of, you know, the astral world will be that bad for him. But all that anger that he took with him, all that self-righteousness, all that superiority, it's not going to make him any happier in his next life than it made him in this life. You know, it just isn't. I watched him from a child and just sort of thought, he's always so crabby about so many things, even when he was little. Now, I spent the last 4 days with Swami Kriyananda, who at the age of 86 is really not the picture of robust physical vitality at this point. In fact, you know, he has a full-time attendant. This lovely woman named Narayani just takes care of him in every way now, and he's entirely dependent on her for just virtually everything. He's still ambulatory, but we walk very, very slowly, and often he has Narayani supports him on one side almost all the time, and David and I would support him on the other side as we wandered the streets of Carmel, you know, just finding a place for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, you know, just looking at the pretty things, buying teacups and Carmel jackets because it's freezing down there and you don't expect it, you know. The biggest stores are the ones that sell warm clothes to all the poor saps who came from the valley thinking it's going to be warm down there. But his consciousness, by, you know, just such an extraordinary change, was a consciousness completely of absolutely giving to everyone. Every person he would meet, he's made this interesting comment. It's not merely that he feels a sense of generous involvement with anyone, everyone in the world. He says everybody looks familiar to him. And I think about Master's statement. It was actually a quote from the Buddha, an autobiography of a yogi. The reason we should be kind to everyone we meet is because in one time or another, in one lifetime or another, we have been close with every single person on this planet. Now, I've never known what to do with that idea. Even Swamiji just sort of goes kind of, wow, you know, what to do with it. But his experience is everybody he meets looks to him like an old friend. And so he greets total strangers with just the same sort of enthusiastic, "Oh, there you are," that you would respond to your husband or your wife if you'd been separated for a few hours. "Oh, there you are." Some people are quite disconcerted by it and have no idea what to think. We make an amusing group, I must say. Swami's in blue, I'm in blue, David's in blue. We're all Naya Swamis, and Narayani's a Brahmacharinian, so she's in yellow. So we're this little parade, you know, of very bright colors. And our clothes, they just don't look normal. David's held on. He looks really normal. But the rest of us really don't. And we're sort of helping this older man down the street who's greeting everybody like an old friend. You know, and complimenting them on their clothes, talking about the weather, chatting with them about their shops. And I mean, it was an absolute delight. I mean, what could be more fun than to just be moving through this world in this bubble of feeling like we're all here for one purpose? Our purpose is to realize and to experience God and to share that with everyone. And everyone around is so busy doing something. Carmel, they have lots of dogs. It became very amusing to us. Dogs and babies. Just everybody has children or dogs. And you see everybody really busy. We met Rogan and Jackson and, you know, all these different. This big, tall Swedish woman had this big, great Dane called Rogan. That was his name, Rogan. He was huge. She was also huge. She said, "I'm a great Swede, and I have a great Dane." And it was just so remarkable. And Swamiji commented once, he said, "Just imagine every single person that you see has this vortex of their own world. And then that vortex touches others. They have their dogs and their cats and their children and their husbands and their parents. And just every one of these vortexes just spinning out in the universe. And we're all interconnected, even if we can't see the whole thing when we just glance out. And the question is only, how are we going to respond? Are we going to spin our own little vortex all the tighter, like my poor beloved uncle who took control of the bagel because it was the last thing that was left, and then would remind me of all the power that he used to have over all the fools when he was strong, and I would just have to say, oh, isn't that nice, you know? And may I help you out of your chair now, you know? Because he couldn't do anything for himself. Or do we become, as Swami becomes, at one point I made some comment about his physical body. Whenever Swami is seated, you know, he doesn't have to move his body around. His energy is exactly the same as it's always been. It's just a question of moving this body. And I made some sort of offhand comment about how interesting it is, with all the willpower he has, that still the body just begins to disintegrate. And he looked at me with a certain look. He's not critical, but it was a certain look like, that was not a very intelligent remark. And he said, "Asha, I just don't care." I just don't care. And yesterday, just before we were leaving him, we were sitting and having coffee. It's very interesting. He's in a very interesting mood, because sometimes he's just sort of, you know, we're looking for a pretty teacup to buy as a present for all the people who have birthdays at this time of year. And the next moment, he's just sitting, and you can see in his eyes that he's just, he can hardly see anything that's around him anymore. And he said, "I look forward," he said, "when this body is gone, to not having any body at all." Now, he didn't mean just no physical body, because you see, most of us, when we pass away, the identification with this individuality is manifested now as a physical body, but when the physical body goes away, our individuality does not leave, because ego belongs also to the astral body. You know, in the movies, how when the actor dies and the same actor gets up, but he can walk through the walls and nobody can see him? That's actually fairly accurate. When we die, nothing actually happens to us except a certain lightness, an intensification of both positive and negative, because the material world dulls our perceptions. But insofar as we are still identified with this individual and its little vortex, all of that identification is registered in the chakras. The physical body goes away, the astral body and the chakras go into the astral world, but we're still ourselves. We're so much ourselves, it's an unfortunate surprise, is how everyone describes it. A positive surprise if you've lived well, and a very unfortunate surprise if you haven't. But we're just there. There is no death. That's what all these people who have what they call near-death experiences, death and return experiences, teach us. We're a little freer because we're not carrying this heavy thing around anymore, but we're still ourselves. So what Swamiji is talking about when he talks about having no body at all is having no limiting consciousness. But the attunement that he has practiced throughout his whole incarnation, since he was 22 and really before, but since he was initiated by Master, and seeing in Master this window to infinity, the sunlight coming through, and realizing that's what I want to be. Swami tells us this story sometimes about when he was a young man meditating after he became Master's disciple. And he said he was a very intelligent and educated man and had a certain amount of pride in his intelligence. Now see, most of us expand ourselves by expanding our self-definition. You see, because we were on the streets just in this vacation town, you see everybody defining themselves in a certain way. There's a man in a jaunty little cap, and you can see him in his jaunty little cap. There's the big Swedish woman with her Great Dane, and she's defining herself as a big Swedish woman with this big dog. And in that way, we've gotten a little bigger. And it's not, if you think of things directionally, necessarily a bad thing. Because otherwise, what is that woman going to do with herself? So now she loves and cares for her dog. So it's a selfless, bigger sense of reality. But the degree to which she defines herself by it, to that extent, we've just drawn one more circumference around us. Just one more circle that says, this is who I am and nothing more. And even death itself won't take that away. But Swamiji was talking about meditating and just feeling what he called his intellectual pride, sort of his sense of self based on the fact that he was such a brilliant man. And all of a sudden, compared to Master's consciousness, compared to the consciousness of infinity, in which everything in creation is perceived to be just one pattern of scintillating light, one movement of infinite joy, one flow of rainbow energy. And then we draw a little circle around ourselves and say, well, I'm very intelligent. I am educated in this way. These are my children. You know, think of all that they've accomplished and by extension, me, like this. Swami said he was in meditation. He said it just felt so confining he couldn't stand it. And in a very loud voice, he shouted, get out, get out, just like that. I'm going to go away from this, no more of this. And then he said he just felt that illusion break. Just that illusion of self-identification, even with the very self that we are. You see, that's the most remarkable part of it. It's not that it isn't here. It's not that he isn't a very intelligent man. It's not that we don't have dogs and children and aren't proud of their accomplishments. It's a question of how we define ourselves. It's a question of the reality in which we live. Is this my truth? Is this when somebody wakes me up in the middle of the night and asks who I am? Am I a dog owner and a mother and an intelligent person? Or do we fall asleep and wake up in that awareness of being one with the infinite? And when Swamiji tells that story of that meditation in which he just cast that egoic self-identification out of himself, he said later he saw Master walking on the tennis court in Mount Washington where Swami was living in Los Angeles. And Swamiji said he went up to the Guru, imagine being able to do this. And he knelt before him for his blessings. Master sort of patted him on the head. Very good, he said, very good. Now, we don't have the opportunity necessarily to see Paramahansa Yogananda walking in the courtyard, although people who can say that he does. Say that he does. We don't have that physical body close to us. But we have that opportunity all the time. Really, every minute of every day, we're making a choice. Who am I? What do I identify with? If I was called out of this universe today, what would I cling to? What would I say that I can't give up? Because whatever we cling to, the reward for clinging is we get to keep it. You know, God doesn't punish us by taking it away from us. He leaves it with us. We just get to stay. In one of the little stores that we were in, they had this knit doll. it was just a perfect doll. I mean, it was, you know, way, way overpriced because we were in Carmel, but it was just this little soft doll, which I sort of clutched like this. And I was almost wishing that I was a child and could just have that baby again. It was so sweet. One of my earliest memories, it may actually be my earliest memories, is of my pink and white teddy bear. And it had a little plastic nose, and I used to suck on the little nose when I would go to sleep. I can still smell it. Can you imagine? But I just remember that feeling of clinging to that little stuffed animal in order to just sort of make myself feel secure as, who knows, this big? How big would you be? The teddy bear seemed really huge to me, so must have been. But is it any different? Now we cling to our education, we cling to our degrees, we cling to our money, we cling to our partners, we cling to our home, whatever it might be. And it's just as fanciful, just as much of an illusion, just as much of a projection onto an inanimate object, a source of security that isn't really coming from there. There's only one reality, and that reality, the good news is, you see, it's always with us. And we imagine ourselves to be without it. So we hoard our money, we hoard our energy, we hoard our love, we protect ourselves from anybody's criticism. We're always trying to show that we really have it together. And then you have Swami Kriyananda just sort of wandering down the streets in Carmel, just greeting everyone. Hello, good morning to you. Happy 4th of July. What a beautiful dress you're wearing. You know, and then he would sit. When we would sit in restaurants, he would always like to be able to see the street. And he would just watch everyone go by. He and Narayani would often sit next to each other, and they would both assume this sort of very concentrated, slightly far away look as we'd look out whatever window. One restaurant in particular, they were so pleased because they had a perfect view like this. It was a very big window. And then people would just come like that. And I was remembering when Master was alive, he in Los Angeles, I've been told, he would go down to what was known as the Bowery District in Los Angeles, where there were lots of bars and people struggling with that kind of limitation. You know, not sufficient to say that I'm my intelligence or my children, but to feel that I can't live without whatever it is that I have to do to change my consciousness so I can survive. And Master would just walk up and down on the sidewalk in that area. Can you imagine? And he said no one ever crossed his path except that it was the will of God that they should do so. Because the way we escape from all this smallness that I'm describing is not by somebody ripping it out of our hands. I was in a toy store once, an educational toy store. And this woman came marching in with her like 3-year-old son, and she was determined. She knew exactly which toy was educationally appropriate for him, and she was just going to go buy it. She was in a hurry. She was going to buy it. But she took her eyes off him for a moment, which was unwise, because in the meantime, he went and rather randomly selected the thing that he wanted. So he had picked up some box, and who knows what was in his mind that caused him to want it, but he'd become quite attached to it, more or less the way, you know, children are a microcosm of the bigger us. So he's holding on to this. His mother wants to give him this one, and she's trying as hard as she can to get him to be interested, because as a modern parent, she's not simply going to overpower him with her will, snatch it out of his hands. She wants to win him to the new. So she keeps talking to him and showing him, and he's becoming a little bit interested in this, and he lets go of one hand, he puts one hand over here, he's still gripping it like this. At this critical moment, she becomes impatient, and she takes this out of his hand, at which point it becomes, of course, the most important thing in the world. The whole thing ended very badly with him screaming, and, you know, she bought what she wanted, she left behind, but she carried him out and having a total tantrum. Are we so different? We've decided, for whatever reasons, karmic reasons, this is what I want, this is who I am, this is what I must be. Maybe we decided completely unconsciously, it just flowed and we find ourselves and now this is who I am. And then Divine Mother dangles in front of us something else that's going to be more developmentally appropriate for us, right? But that doesn't mean it looks attractive to us now. And often the more that's dangled in front of us, the more tightly we grip onto what we already know. Whether it's our youthful body, our image of ourselves, my uncle's determination that he's still the smartest man in the room, and if they would just let him, he could run the whole place better than any of them. And at the very least, he's going to control this bagel. Absolutely, he's going to control this bagel. And Divine Mother's putting in front of him, you're an old man now. You know, be grateful for what's given to you. Be kind to these people who are taking care of you. Just, it's important to receive and not only to give. So your days of being the smartest man in the room are over. Why don't you be the nicest man in the room? How's that for another way to be? My own father, I am very pleased to say, the very last words he spoke were, thank you, just like that. And he took a slightly different approach than my uncle. Just, he was elder and somebody gave him some water and then he never spoke again. But it was so sweet that the last words, and he said it with this sense of, oh, he was so pleased, somebody gave him water. Thank you. Just like that. Why do we have to wait? Why do we have to wait till we're so old and God has ripped everything else out of our hands? You know, this is what the scriptures are telling us, the masters are telling us. Life all around us is telling us, you know, everything is part of that divine flow. If we want to separate out a little tiny piece and cling to it, it's really literally like just grabbing a handful of the river and demanding it that it stay this way. Not a chance. And it doesn't really affect the river. We can have the biggest tantrum in the world. It's just going to run the way it runs. And either we step into that flow, like Swami looking at me when I were helping him around the car and helping him into the car and, you know, moving his legs. He's at that point. My father was there. My uncle was there. Where you get into the car and you can't even get your own leg in. Swami's still walking most of the time, but you have to lift his leg into the car. And he just looks, Asha, I just don't care. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that where we all want to be? Eventually, why not now? You know, why not now? Why not in this moment embrace the infinite? That's all that's ever ours and ever will be. And that is the source. Everything else is an inanimate object upon which we have projected our happiness. When in fact, it all goes away from us for one reason and one reason only, is to give us back what has always been ours, which is that presence of God and that infinite bliss within. God bless you.